From the Sky News Centre at 6, the family of a Bristol woman who threw herself and her newborn baby off a cliff have called for a dedicated mental health service for new mothers. An inquest found a series of failings contributed to the death of Charlotte Bevan and her daughter, and that no care plan was in place, despite a history of mental illness. The 30-year-old's mother, Rachel Fortune, made a short statement outside the coroner's court.
Following from what has been heard in evidence, the family would urge the commissioners to fund a dedicated perinatal mental health service.
A British nurse who survived Ebola is in a serious condition after being readmitted to the UK's high-level isolation ward in London. Pauline Cafferkey from South Lanarkshire was first taken to hospital in December after contracting the virus in Sierra Leone. She's being treated for what's described as a late complication of the infection. Catherine Calderwood is Chief Medical Officer for Scotland and says the danger to public health is minimal.
It's important to say that when patients are asymptomatic, so when they themselves are well, there is not enough viral load in their system for them to be infectious. So while Pauline remained well, there was no risk at all of transmission.
A teenager appeared at Liverpool Crown Court charged with the murder of PC Dave Phillips in Wallasey on Monday. 18-year-old Clayton Williams was refused bail and remanded in custody until the 22nd of October. NHS trusts in England have revealed losses of almost £1 billion in the first 3 months of the financial year. Shadow Health Secretary Heidi Alexander says the figures show an NHS in crisis. FIFA could consider delaying next year's presidential elections. A successor to the outgoing and currently suspended Sepp Blatter is due to be confirmed next February. And the former Antiques Roadshow presenter Hugh Scully has died at the age of 72. His son Oliver said his father died on Thursday afternoon while watching TV at his home in Cornwall. He presented the Antiques Roadshow for almost 20 years. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
Love Bristol. Love. BCFM 93.2.
Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, hey, can I be a member and be initiated? With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy. That's what Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt determined at Yalta. Who was going to be the enemy post-war? Turned out to be Stalin. And there was going to be this phony Cold War, so that the population would never discover the real enemy. And I'm talking about the population of the Soviet Union as well as the rest of the world. You see, the enemy has always been here. It's your uncle, your aunt, your father, your mother, your brother, your sister, your nephew, your nieces, who belong to the fraternal orders collectively known as the Mysteries.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist. No, not this week, but just me, Tony Gosling. Fleeing from a four-year-long civil war, herded into a refugee camp, then turned out to take the long walk to find a new life in Europe. The refugee crisis, human cargo. Tonight, we're joined by journalist and author Alex Perry, whose book, The Rift, A New Africa Breaks Free, has just been published. He's been looking closely at the reasons why people are leaving their homes. And who are the mysterious marine commandos some refugees have been encountering while crossing the Mediterranean? Also, Katie Hope's here from Bristol Refugee Rights, also to explain what happens when the refugees reach our city. And the BBC transmitted its long-delayed Panorama documentary called The VIP Paedophile Scandal, What's the Truth? As if they know, on Tuesday evening this week, which purported to show most of the claims, particularly against former Home Secretary Leon Britton, were false. It also portrayed London's XRO news agency, where many of those stories have come from, as failing to check their facts. So, is that it? Was the VIP paedophile scandal just a bout of paranoia from some bad apples? Or did Panorama tiptoe around the hard evidence? Trial by television of witnesses? And what did the Metropolitan Police think of the documentary in which they also appeared? Well, I'm joined on the line to discuss that now with the former First Tuesday producer, Tim Tate. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, Tim. Can you hear me? Tim, can you hear me?
I can indeed.
Tim, what did you make of the programme on Tuesday, the Panorama? Because, as I've been saying there, there are quite a lot of suspicions, really, that that this was a partial documentary. Was it the sort of documentary you would have made?
Probably not, no. I think the difficulty is that Panorama got sucked into some of the very same faults as the prime source of the allegations that they were complaining about, and that's this organisation, XRO News. And I think if Panorama essentially did much the same as XRO has done, which is to rely on witnesses or testimony from people who cannot support and their allegations and really have severe credibility issues.
So, I mean, I suppose what you're saying there is that, and it hadn't actually occurred to me, that Panorama were relying on the same unreliable witnesses that XRO had been.
Yes, I mean, that's roughly what I was trying to point out in my blog the other day. It's perfectly reasonable to question XRO's behaviour, which has been both bizarre and, in my view, very dangerous. But to base a fair amount of your demolition job on XRO on the evidence of a witness who Panorama themselves on air said worried about his reliability, and rightly, I think is equally dubious.
Let's just go back 20 years or so to when you did a documentary about this, because you actually did uncover that there were some very powerful paedophiles in the Republican Party in the United States. I mean, we're obviously not saying necessarily that that sort of thing's going on here in Britain, but what did you discover was happening in America?
What I discovered was allegations, and what I did with those allegations was to seek some form of corroborative evidence, which is, I think, the great problem here, that there has been very little effort expended to seek corroboration. And I found the corroboration I needed for that film in an entire roomful of documents, which were grand jury testimony and indeed testimony before a state Senate inquiry.
So what was actually going on in the United States in the Republican Party?
Well, the allegation was that children in Nebraska, as that in that case, had been prostituted across the state and indeed to the corridors of power in Washington, D.C., up to and including the doors of Capitol Hill. And there was a deal of testimony given largely in secret, as I say, at grand jury hearings or state Senate hearings, which corroborated each other.
Now, I noticed that here in the UK, when that paranormal documentary was going on, the Metropolitan Police actually issued a press release, or certainly a statement of some sort. As the documentary itself was going out, it was starting to appear on the websites of some of the broadsheet newspapers, actually saying that the result of that programme on Tuesday could be to intimidate witnesses. I mean, do you think that's a fair thing to do? Because it actually seems like what they were doing was, even though they had agreed to participate in the Panorama programme, they were criticising it too.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, and if I'm wrong, I apologise, that statement from the Met was issued prior to broadcast, and whether the Met, I'd be surprised if the Met saw the film before broadcast, because that would be a very unusual step for any broadcaster to take. The Met statement was odd. There was nothing in that film which, in my view, would deter a victim of child sexual abuse from coming forward and making a complaint. Whatever else its faults, that film did not do what its enemies, and that's primarily, again, XRO, alleged it would do, which was, and I quote, to smear victims of smear survivors of child sexual abuse. I mean, it just didn't do that, and it was, frankly, something of a damp squib in every other sense.
I mean, if you had had the budget of Panorama, which is a pretty astronomical amount, what would you have done differently? Because, I mean, when I was looking at it, I was thinking, well, they seem to be focusing on some of the bad witnesses. I mean, there are actually very good witnesses out there. Is it fair for Panorama to make a programme where it looks like they have focused on witnesses who are unreliable? Because there is some evidence, isn't there? And they were actually effectively saying, and this was the headline, I think, in the Daily Mail, on the front page of the Daily Mail today, that was exonerating Leon Britton of any kind of involvement in this.
Yeah, I think there's two or three separate questions. Working backwards, Panorama did certainly give the impression at the end that Leon Britton was a man whose reputation had been unfairly traduced by a succession of bogus or dodgy allegations. There is some truth, I think, in that, insofar as the allegations are dubious or at best unreliable because of the sources of those informations. That does not make them wrong, it does not make them necessarily false, it just means they are very suspect and you have to tread very carefully. However, there is other evidence which I've published both on my website and indeed through national newspapers, which shows, for example, that there is a formal statement from a customs officer to the Metropolitan Police's Operation Fernbridge in which he describes stopping Leon Britton at customs at Dover, searching his car and finding a child pornography videotape. Now, that is a formal statement. It's sitting in the files of Operation Fernbridge. Panorama knows about that. It's no great secret. I published it last year. If you're going to raise the issue of Leon Britton, I think it's only right that you do so in a responsible, even-handed, and indeed accurate way, and I don't think Panorama did that. All of that said, I don't think Panorama's the problem. I mean, I think in 10, 5, or even 4 years' time, that Panorama programme will not really trouble anyone as a particularly fine piece of journalism. The problem is what, unfortunately, you have to recognise as the other side, and that's the increasingly hysterical shouting of those who proclaim that there is cast iron evidence of a VIP or political paedophile ring. And there could be. I'm not saying there isn't. What I'm saying is that the absolute certainty with which this has been proclaimed in very loud voices and all over both the mainstream and the social media is absolutely very, very dangerous, because there isn't
about the complaints that have been to the IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, allegedly anyway, by up to five special branch officers, that they witnessed investigations being closed down, Tim?
As to the best of my knowledge, what the IPCC has said is that it is investigating a number, it's a fairly large number, of cases in which allegations have been made that police investigations were closed down, and that certainly in some of these cases those allegations have come from former police officers. And that, I think, is very, very serious. I think that's, if the IPCC's investigations show that that is true, and that those investigations were closed down, then I think that is a very serious scandal. But, and I keep having to come back to this, what we are dealing with at this stage is allegations. And it's perfectly fair and right, in my view as a journalist, to say, well, we report those allegations. What is not good journalism, and is in this overheated climate is very dangerous, is to proclaim those allegations as fact.
Now, your blog, which is at timtate.co.uk, you talk about the louse and the flea. Why do you draw some sort of analogy between this Brothers Grimm fairy tale and what was going on Panorama on Tuesday?
Well, for those who haven't read Grimm's Fairy Tale number 30, the tale of the louse and the flea, it's very briefly, it's the story of a louse and a flea who lived together very happily, and the louse had a catastrophic accident while brewing some beer. It threw the flea into a tailspin, and the ensuing drama consumed the entire household, household objects, a child, and a stream which overflowed and finally drowned everybody. What struck me, both about the Panorama and about the allegations it was investigating, emanating, again, I have to stress this, primarily from Exero, is that what has happened is that Exero has published, without any due diligence, any corroborative checks, very serious allegations, has sent the mainstream media and social media and the climate, if you like, into a tailspin, much as the louse's demise did with everything in its house. And Panorama sadly fell into the trap, it became the flea, of following the same pattern. What has happened is that this has become trench warfare, with people on either side of the argument shouting at each other and adopting a position which is binary. It's either all true or it's all false. And the reality is that there are going to be bits of this that are true, there are going to be bits of this that are false, and what is needed, and if this is my main interest, if you like, as a journalist, as a long and old in the tooth journalist, is that when you're dealing with allegations, incendiary allegations, you don't just shove them up on a website or sell them to a tabloid newspaper or an Australian television company, as Exero did, and say, well, we're just publishing what people told us. You actually have a duty to do some investigation of your own, to check out the background, to try and find some corroborative evidence. And if you don't, what you're doing is not free speech. It's actually undermining both free speech, and it is creating a climate in which good child protection and the protection of children from sexual abuse is going to be set back. It's going to be washed. That's going to be washed away in the backlash, which is growing and is becoming ever nastier, in my view.
But Tim, surely the only reason that this has been journalists, maybe with on very low budgets, have been dealing with this story is because the police simply haven't been doing their job. And when they have started doing their job, there's I noticed on the LBC website, one of their top clips from the last week was one of the former police officers rang into LBC saying that they'd been investigating a massive paedophile ring, including some very senior figures in the East End, and the night before. Sorry,
I can barely hear you.
Me now is that some former police officer rang into LBC, the London station, earlier this week and said that an investigation into a paedophile ring in the East End, where there had been several very senior people involved in that, they were about to make mass arrests, and it was just simply the night before the superintendent announced, well, the on-highs have been onto us, we're going to have to end this investigation, there'll be no arrests in the morning. When that sort of culture is around in the police, isn't it inevitable that the media, whether right or wrong, good or bad, are going to start picking up these allegations?
It's certainly inevitable, and I think, to be honest, it's right. I mean, it's one of the things we should be doing, and you know, it's the great sorrow that, by and large, my colleagues have failed to do that for many years. You know, one of our jobs is to be the watchdog that barks at power. But you can't simply say, well, someone's made an allegation, I'm going to stick it out there and present it as fact, which is exactly, precisely what XRO has done.
Now, isn't part of the reason for that, Tim, the fact that we don't really have the kind of massive budgets that people like you used to have back in the 1980s to
I hate to disagree with you, Tony, but I happen to have seen XRO's accounts. And XRO was started with a £5 million loan. It has spent approximately £2.5 million of that over the last couple of years. Now, frankly, even in the glory days on the Cook Report or on First Tuesday or thereafter, I never had that kind of money.
Okay, Tim Tate, your website, maybe you'd like to just give that a plug and tell us about some of the books you've published recently, because I know you're pretty knowledgeable about this and a pretty prolific author.
Should anyone want to look, it's timtate.co.uk.
And your latest book?
My latest book is a book called Yorkshire Ripper, The Secret Murders, which is, I think, precisely the sort of journalism and investigative journalism which I've been criticising others for not doing. It stems from a 3-year investigation by a former police officer. It deals very carefully with facts, and it looks and found corroborative evidence which showed that Peter Sutcliffe is the most likely suspect for 23 unsolved murders, in addition to those for which he was convicted.
Okay, investigative journalist, former producer for First Tuesday, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thanks a lot, Tony.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, the refugee crisis, Hume and Cargo. Tonight, we're joined in the studio by journalist and author Alex Perry, whose book, The Rift, A New Africa Breaks Free, has just been published. Hi, Alex. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what inspired you to get into this subject and why you wrote the book, Alex.
I was posted to Africa. I was Africa bureau chief for Time magazine, and I was there for the best part of a decade. But the reason I wrote the book was almost from the moment I got to Africa, it became clear that our perceptions of Africa were way off, basically. And I, you know, turning to tonight's topic, the migrant crisis, you see the same thing happening there. I mean, it's African migrants are generally described as economic migrants, therefore bad migrants. You know, we'll take people running from a war, refugees from Syria or Afghanistan, but anyone coming to better themselves is kind of seen as, you know, having greed as a motive and therefore bad, therefore a bad migrant. I mean, there's so many sort of misconceptions in that that, you know, it kind of illustrates why I wrote the book. I mean, first of all, the cost of coming here is $5,000 to $10,000 to take a passage with people smugglers across the Sahara and on a leaky boat across across the Med. So these are not, you know, that's quite a lot of money. So the idea that these are sort of destitute Africans looking to come to somehow, I don't know, get into the welfare system or take sort of low-paid menial jobs is very often wrong. $10,000 is generally means that the people waiting around in detention centres in Sicily and so on are kind of middle-class guys with degrees, you know, and they're... Imagine the kind of the grit and the determination it takes across the Sahara and then the Mediterranean. These are self-starters. These are people with a plan. They're actually exactly the kind of migrants that you want to come to your country. They're going to start something. They're going to create something. You know, they will be a benefit. And if you look at a place like Northern Europe, where the population is aging and running out of young workers and young managers, these are, you know, any economist will tell you, these are the guys that you want.
Well, hang on a minute, because most of the countries in Europe, maybe Germany excepted, are in totally the opposite situation, Alex, aren't they? They've got lots of unemployed. I mean, look at, for example, Spain and Italy. They're completely the opposite, where they're actually struggling to house and employ most of the people in their own country.
Well, the migrants aren't stopping in Southern Europe. They're not going to the places where there aren't great economic prospects. They're looking, you know, they're smart. They read ahead. You know. The other, it's only just dawned on the UK, for instance, that almost none of them are coming here. They're almost all going to Germany, because Germany has a very efficient processing system. You know, Germany's going to take, what, close to 1 million people this year.
Do you think there's been a deliberate attempt to confect the two between... There is quite obviously a lot of people been released from refugee camps in Turkey, and these people are coming in a completely different point of view, really. They're, most of them are trying to escape a massive civil war, which has devastated their country. And isn't there been, potentially anyway, a deliberate attempt to conflate people who are coming deliberately to try and get work in Northern Europe to better themselves and their families with those who are fleeing death?
Well, no, I mean, I think you see a real division. I mean, certainly from the politicians, you know, the politicians will say, well, we, you know, the guys coming from fleeing war and devastation, those are the ones we'll accept. Actually, they legally have to accept those ones. They're not allowed to refuse them anyway.
Well, what about when they put a giant great wall up, which is actually physically stopping them getting into the country? That's refusing them, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think that's basically illegal, as far as I understand it.
So you'd be perfectly within your legal rights to get a giant great pair of bolt cutters and chop your way through.
Well, I think under the convention, you know, UN Convention of Human Rights, if someone arrives in your country destitute, having fled, you know, a place where their life is in danger, I think I think I'm right in saying under international law that you're legally bound to accept them. You know, that they have a legal right to apply for asylum in your country.
Katie Hope from Bristol Refugee writes, is that right?
Hi, yeah, hi. Actually, well, it's the UN Convention on Refugees, 1951 Convention. You have to prove that you individually have been persecuted, so it's not just a blanket statement for anyone fleeing a war. You've got to prove that you individually have been targeted as because of race, religion, membership of a particular social group.
But what if, say, the house next door to you has just blown up and been blown up and you feel, well, maybe I'm going to be next, so I better get out of here?
Well, certainly in developing countries, there's a kind of understanding that there's a de facto refugee status. If a huge number of people cross a border because they're being blown up, then you take it on face value that those people cannot return. And the key issue about being a refugee is that you've been forced to cross an international border. Your government will no longer protect you, and therefore you're in need of international protection. So
what are your thoughts about the same question I ask Alex about this attempt to conflate the two, the migrants, economic migrants, so there clearly are some, and refugees from people who are quite within their rights to claim asylum because they've had to flee the possibility of death?
I think it sort of comes down to sort of slightly lazy journalism, really. It's just not really bothering to look into the reasons why people flee, and there's lots of reasons for forced displacement that don't quite live up to that very high standard of the International Convention of to be a refugee. There's still people who are migrants who have protection needs, for example. I'm sure you must have come across those in Africa, you know, huge numbers of people who might not individually face persecution or, you know, have that as the basis for their reason to flee, but they still have really huge humanitarian needs. And lots of countries are a bit better. I mean, we do this in the UK, but lots of the European countries have a whole system of protection for those people, which is called humanitarian protection. It's not full refugee status, but it's recognising they're not economic migrants. They actually have some sort of, you know, protection needs.
Alex, let's go back to what you were saying about people coming, particularly to get work, get jobs, start a new life for economic reasons. What are the reasons in Africa that they do that? I mean, is it fair to say that they're just trying to get a bigger house, a bigger car, that sort of thing?
It tends to be a sort of medium-term plan. I mean, from the guys that I've spoken to who make the journey from Africa and from the guys that I've met...
I suppose I'm saying, why now? Why not 10 years ago? Why not 15 years ago?
Well, funny enough, I mean, kind of slightly paradoxically, it's because Africa's getting richer. And because they're getting richer, you can afford that passage. Like, before, there was just no possibility of even leaving the village. Now you've been able to first of all, stay at school till you're 18 or possibly even go for universities. So you're better educated, you've got ambitions, you've got ideas, you know about Bill Gates, you've heard about, you know, different industries.
Maybe you read it on social media.
Right. But it's become a possibility to you now that it wouldn't have done if you'd left school, you know, after 4 years or something
Is it as simple as saying, well, somebody's going to provide that service to get me there where I don't need a visa, I don't need to go through all the, you know, the usual things I would have to do to gain legal entry to a country?
Well, okay, think of the flip side. I mean, for me, right, I'm a foreign correspondent. I travel to all these countries legally and for about a tenth of the price. You know, so it's simply, you know, that's the only method available. Can't get a visa, can't get on a flight without a visa, therefore have to go through the illegal channels. You know, I mean, so you know, I guess what's impressive to me is that people will still pay all that money to come, you know. And as I say, it's paradoxically it's a function of Africa getting richer. And the plan is generally not to stay here forever. It's almost always to improve your standing back home. So you work for maybe 5 or 10 years, most of the money seems to be directed towards building a house. And then you arrive back home triumphantly after having, you know, made your fortune in a far off land, and you marry the best girl in the village. That's generally sort of the plan. And it tends to be the second son. The first son stays there, runs the family, he's the head of the family. It tends to be the second son that is, it's a kind of family council that goes, right, you go and see what happens.
Now, is it a question that over maybe the last 10 years or so, this has started to happen, more people have actually come back, built houses, got that status, and that has almost been like a big advert to go and try and
make your fortune
up in Northern Europe?
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. And then, you know, it's also, you know, the idea is that if you come in and you get a European wage, well, that'll go a lot further. So it's a kind of accelerator. You know, if you work for 5 years and save a fair amount, you go back to Ghana or wherever, you know, that'll buy a lot.
It's almost like you come back a millionaire kind of thing.
Well, it'll probably be enough to, you know, as I say, build a house and maybe start a business, you know, maybe have a couple of cars, that kind of stuff. So it's, yeah, it's an accelerator. But no, I don't see that many people. I mean, refugees are very different. They're, you know, particularly, you know, the influx you see from Syria now seems to be, you know, millions of people who have given up the idea of ever going home. You know, they've been 4 years in camps and they're saying, you know, it's gone, we have to move on. Whereas
funnily enough, actually things have been turning around there. I just wonder if you've got any comments about what's been happening over the last week or so with, you know, actually 2 weeks now, isn't it? The Russians have been bombing and sending cruise missiles in to apparently take out ISIS and other Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front. It may even be that the end of the civil war in Syria is in sight now. The Russians have intervened. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, I, you know, my thoughts are probably the same as anybody else, but in terms of, you know, I don't have any sort of direct reporting on the ground there, and so few do now. I mean, so much of Syria is essentially an information black hole to so many of us. But it, yeah, from what I read, it does seem that the Russians are not going to let Assad fall, and that in some way, you know, that may build some stability around Damascus. But the reasons the Russians went in was because it seemed like Damascus might fall. So I don't think it's in any way stable. in Syria right now.
Yeah, and it's not going to be time to go back. Back to you, Katie. I mean, actually, maybe I should just finish by pinning you down, Alex, on this business. Do you think there's been an attempt to conflate refugees with these migrants you're talking about?
No. What I see actually is almost exactly the opposite. Is that, you know, the you know what David Cameron would call the swarm is you know, is, well, okay. People come together. You know, if you're coming from somewhere like Libya, you know, it's a real mix of people from who originate in different places, different nationalities, different ages even, sometimes a lot of unaccompanied children. And they arrive conflated. But what you see is a very deliberate effort to say, okay, you are deserving because you're being persecuted, but you just want to get richer, so out. And I think that's, it's economically illiterate. You know, migration is fantastic for the economy, and any economist will tell you that. Look at all the richest countries in the world. They have high migration.
Well, the economist might tell you, but unemployed people here won't, will they?
Well, the evidence that migrants displace unemployed people from work is just not there. It's just not there. Theresa May, actually, her own department put out, figures last year saying that was the case. You know, her speech this week was kind of factually unfounded, you know. But if you want to be isolated, if you want no migration, you're saying we want to be North Korea, we want to be Eritrea, you know, static, stasis, and really quite poor.
Katie, I wonder what your reaction was to Theresa May's speech this week. I know the city, actually, I was quite surprised to see many big business organisations right across the country pretty much roundly condemning what she'd said. And she's setting out her stall to be the leader. We know, actually, Boris is going to almost certainly be the leader. It does seem like she's shot herself in the foot.
Yeah, I really hope she has. It was just the most horrific bit of speech I've ever heard. But what was really sad about it is that underpinning all those disgusting views is actually an immigration bill, which, with all this focus on what's happening with refugees in Europe, is sort of slipping a little bit unseen behind this, you know, behind the walls of Parliament. It's got its second reading next Tuesday, and certainly for those people fleeing war and persecution, like you were talking about, Alex, you know, it's going to be horrendous. We already treat asylum seekers very differently from any other needy person in the UK. They're already on half the levels of what people on income support would be on, and they've just cut the rates for families. So all of this rhetoric about supporting people only overseas that are in resettlement camps and taking the most vulnerable, well, actually, just look at what we're about to do within the UK.
Now, you've said that we're treating asylum seekers differently to other people in the UK who are claiming benefits. What about comparing how Britain treats asylum seekers to other parts of the EU?
Yeah, well, that's really important too. And, you know, if you looked at what the government was saying, I think you'd think that we were taking enormous numbers in the UK. In actual fact, asylum seekers made up only 8% of those who came to the UK. 8%, it's absolutely tiny.
You've also got to look at the inequality here as well. I mean, but basically you have the number of people born outside the UK living in the UK are more or less balanced by the people from the UK living overseas. You know, I think the amount in the UK is 4.7 million. I think the amount of Brits working overseas, like me, is about 4 million. You know, so it's kind of unfair to say it's fine for you to migrate and travel and work if you're from a rich country, but if you're from a poor country, you stay where you are. You know, there's, you know, basically we, in this age of globalization, we seem to have globalized capital, but not labor.
What are your thoughts about this immigration bill that's coming along, Alex? Because it's certainly, from what Katie's saying, it's going to make things more difficult for asylum seekers. Actually,
well, I mean, the immigration debate in this country seems to be sort of heavily coloured by the idea that, you know, which essentially came out of the rise of UKIP, that there is a large, well, it's an idea in the politicians' minds, I think, that there is a large population out there that will be motivated by some sort of prejudice.
But they are, they're actually UKIP, although they only got one MP, actually got quite a sizeable slice of the vote in the general election.
They did. But did you also notice during the election campaign how many embarrassments UKIP had when, you know, candidate after member turned out to be racist? You know, what a surprise that was. And what I'm seeing actually over the last couple of months is a rapid growing sophistication in how this issue is perceived and being treated. And I think actually, you know, politicians like Theresa May, who think they're onto a vote winner here, have sort of fallen behind the curve. There's you know, people have a much more nuanced view of immigration than they did even 6 months ago.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to a clip from Theresa May's speech earlier this week and see what you both make of it.
At the moment, for example, workers coming to the UK on very low salaries can claim over £10,000 on top of their salary in benefits, which makes the UK a hugely attractive destination. This is not good for us or for the countries those people are leaving. That is why the Prime Minister is right to target the amount we pay in benefits for those coming to the UK to work, and put these arrangements on a sensible basis. So these are the main reasons why net migration is still too high. But the trouble is, other changes mean that without the right policies, it's going to get even harder to get the numbers down. Modern forms of communication, cheaper international travel, and the increase in relative prosperity for many people in the developing world mean that large numbers of people are more mobile than ever before. And this is compounded by several other factors. For years, despite its many other flaws and its criminal leadership, Libya was known as Europe's forward border. British immigration officials worked there with their European and Libyan counterparts to stop illegal immigration from Africa at its source. Now the criminal gangs that smuggle people into Europe have been able to work unimpeded. Free movement rules don't just mean European nationals have the right to reside in Britain. They now mean anybody who is married a European can come here almost without condition. And Schengen, the agreement that abolished borders between EU states apart from Britain and Ireland, means that once a migrant arrives in a country with weak border controls, like Greece, they can make their way across Europe and into Germany or up to the British border at Calais without checks. Many of those people will eventually get EU citizenship and the free movement rights that come with it. Even actions taken with the best of intentions have consequences. When the German government, motivated by compassion and decency, said they expected to receive 800,000 asylum seekers this year, it prompted hundreds of thousands of people to try to get to Germany. Some of these people were refugees, coming directly from Syria or the camps in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. But many, in fact up to half of them, were migrants from other parts of the world. So reducing and controlling immigration is getting harder. But that's no reason to give up. As our manifesto said, we must work to control immigration and put Britain first.
Well, not quite as long a round of applause as David Cameron got when he had a go at Jeremy Corbyn, but what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, yeah, some of the points there were quite just based on very little, really. Why do we need less immigration? But I suppose for me, I'm talking on behalf of Bristol Refugee Rights. My key point here is her demonising of asylum seekers who make their way to the UK. There's some bizarre thing that she came up with in her speech that if you've managed to get to the UK, you're somehow going to be a fit young man who is not deserving of protection. But if you're taken from the camps surrounding, you know, refugee conflicts, that you're much more deserving. The irony is that when it comes to the new immigration bill, what Theresa May wants to do is take away support from families and make them destitute in cities like Bristol. So that's going to happen to the people that we have who come to our centre. So if your claim for asylum is rejected, which many are, they get the decision-making wrong in 30% of cases, so 30% are overturned at appeal. All those people at the moment are entitled to some form of support if they can't return to their country of origin. When this immigration bill's passed, they won't be entitled to anything. So suddenly the local authority will have large numbers of families with children who, under the Children Act, cannot be left destitute to support. So it's going to increase tension, apart from anything else, apart from making people homeless and destitute.
I mean, isn't the obvious thing to do for these people, if they're destitute, just simply to start working for organised crime? And that's what normally happens in most parts of the developing world.
Well, certainly reports that charities have done into destitution meant that they are absolutely forced into some sort of organised crime, prostitution. You know, they are really the most vulnerable people, and they are exploited in the UK, you know, if they're left in that position. So yes, you're absolutely right.
Just give us an idea of what Bristol Refugee Rights actually does, because you mean, you know, maybe looking at a couple of cases without going into names, and the bulk of what you deal with during the year.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so we've been around for 9 years now. We are a welcome centre that's open 3 days a week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and we really offer that support, both emotional support and practical support, that will help people when they arrive in the country and when they're newly given refugee status as well. We find people, they turn up, we have people from all sorts of backgrounds. We were talking about Africa earlier, a lot of people from Africa, from fleeing, you know, conflicts in various different countries, and they come with nothing. They're absolutely bewildered. They've probably had a horrendous journey, and Alex has written an interesting book about, you know, what happens during that journey of being smuggled across Europe. They arrive in the UK and they have to go through the asylum process, which is a really tough process. You know, as I said before, you're proving that you individually have been targeted. It's not enough just to have fled in a generalised way. And they sometimes wait for a long time for a decision. They often have their decisions turned down, at which point their support is under question. And they're living, as I said before, on really low amounts of money, having bought nothing here and having no support networks here. But the key thing that we do in our centre is to try and address that isolation, the need to learn English, which is actually really hard now. You know, the same government that's trying to reduce the number of asylum seekers and is talking about not wanting too many migrants is actually making it more difficult to learn English. So we provide English classes and British life classes, which just explain some of the customs here, with a creche. We do work to help people with their cases, so around, you know, getting that support that they need, finding a solicitor that's an effective solicitor and helping them with their case, and just simple things like really warm, welcoming atmosphere where they can get a hot meal, which is often the only hot meal they get in the week, a haircut, a massage. It's just a really lovely place to come along and be. It's very supportive to those people.
But what do you say to those, particularly unemployed people, people who've lost their jobs, instead of applying for job after job after job, who point their finger at people who've come from other countries and saying, well, they're taking our jobs?
Why does it have to be either or? I guess, you know, I would feel just as supportive towards someone who is unemployed in this country as I would do towards the people that we work with. I don't see why do the poor people in this society have to be pitted against each other? You know, there's plenty of wealth in this country to go around to support everyone who's in need. And I'm not saying, you know, that's the focus of my work.
Well,
I know my work is
about certainly when it comes to welfare, the government would disagree with you, wouldn't they? They'd say, actually, no, there isn't enough wealth to go around.
Yeah, they would. Yeah. Yeah, well...
Okay, well, maybe
that's another show, really, isn't it?
Alex, coming back to you, tell us a little bit about who's making the money out of these other ways, unofficial ways, where you're not applying for a visa to get from Africa and countries to Europe.
That's the great irony of Theresa May's speech. You know, here is the Home Secretary, the person who's in charge of law and order, and she's proposing a policy that essentially helps provide an opportunity worth billions of dollars for organised crime. You know, the African organised crime is making billions out of this, smuggling people across the Sahara and across the Mediterranean. Once they arrive in Europe, I was down in Sicily earlier this year looking into the Italian mafia's involvement in detention centres. Basically, they rigged the contracts to manage detention centres. And they keep people there for as long as they can. You know, I was talking to a bunch of, there were some Ethiopian guys and Nigerian guys. They're supposed to be processed in 6 weeks. They've been there 2 years because the guys that run the centre are making 32 euros a head a day from 5,000 people in that centre. You know, that's hundreds of millions of dollars. And so, you know, you have this situation where the forces of law and order who are saying we can't let undesirables in are actually boosting undesirables at home. They're boosting organised crime.
Also joined by Kevin Boylan. Kevin, you've done a little report for us, haven't you? Thank you very much. On this very strange phenomenon of, and there's been a little peppered through some of the press reports to do with what's been going on in the Mediterranean as people are crossing. Reports of Marines, military, actually appearing halfway across on the crossing. So would you just like to tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. Basically, I was in Lesvos Island in August, late August, and while I was there, I interviewed a refugee named Mohammed, and he told me about some attackers involved in clandestine maritime interceptions of refugees, stroke migrants, between Turkey and Greece, and these are known colloquially as German commandos. Although Mohammed made his crossing without incident, luckily, he did tell me that some of the Syrians in his dinghy had done so previously and were terrified that such an encounter would be repeated. Luckily, they arrived on the north side of the island rather than the south, where that would have happened. He told me about a Facebook page in Arabic where references to the commandos may be found. I don't have any Arabic, so but I have discovered that the Arabic characters used at the site form an expression in Syrian or Palestinian dialect that means the center or station, as in coach station, of those displaced who are having a difficult life. These commandos are dubbed German because they apparently speak either German or English when they intercept the boats. Many are reputedly blue-eyed. They are disciplined, they dress in black, balaclavas, carry US weaponry, M16s. They only operate at night, with their usual practice being to disable a refugee boat, search it for its occupants, that means permanently disable a refugee boat, seizing all their possessions, passports, money, etc. The commandos then throw the mobiles that they find into the water to prevent the victims calling for help. Men are beaten up, and the commandos tow the boat back to the Turkish waters, where the refugees are left to their fate. If they're lucky, they get picked up the next day by the Turkish Coast Guard, but if not, well, you can imagine. The waters between Turkey and Lesbos are patrolled by regular vessels of the Turkish and Greek Coast Guards, in addition to those of Frontex, this being the European Frontier Police. All three of these forces have been implicated in what's known as pushbacks and other crimes against international law, although it's clear that there are other more shadowy actors operating as well, including these commandos. Early on this year, the Greek Coast Guard was investigated internally in Greece for collaborating with unidentified civilian elements in pushbacks and robbery. But this has been allegedly stopped by the Syriza government. There are also, in all likelihood, criminal pirate gangs familiar with the waters operating out of Turkey that may try to rob migrants, and these freelance or irregular elements add a certain amount of confusion to the story.
Okay, Kevin, well, thanks very much for that, and we'll post some links to some of the articles that you've used to source that report on the show page. That's at thisweek.org.uk. Well, I better ask you about that first, Alex. What do you think's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, that's not something I've heard about. What I do know is that those that are trying to police the boats coming over are completely overwhelmed. I mean, for every rescue there are three or four that are unrescued, some of which sink, you know, and if there is, I guess if there's something that is, if you're going to try and judge the seriousness of these situations, I'd say, you know, more than 2,000 people drowning without any assistance or intent from anybody else at all would be, I mean, that's a humanitarian disaster in itself. But I guess I wouldn't be that surprised if there was a kind of a local vigilante group trying to send back migrants. I mean, you know, you get the same thing on land in almost every European country. It wouldn't be all that surprising to find a group being enterprising and doing it at sea. I don't know about M16s and all the rest of that, but, you know, certainly wherever there's a mass migration, it will produce, you know, resentment in a certain part of the receiving population.
Tell us a little bit about this guy you mentioned in your Newsweek article. The last, I think it was the last edition, wasn't it, of Newsweek Europe, this went in just about under the wire.
before the news wake.
Yeah. Yes. I bet it was a good party anyway when you closed down. But anyway, Emias Ghamani, if I've pronounced it right, seemed to be making quite a lot of money out of getting people across the Mediterranean.
Fortune. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's making... If you one of those little rubber ducks, rubber dinghies, you know, you can get about 250 people. If they're all paying 2,000 euros a head, something like that, I mean, you know, do the math. That's about, what is that, 550,000 a boat, 80,000 boats, something like that. I mean, it's a lot. And this guy's sending 20, 30 boats a year, and he's been doing it for 8 years, 9 years now. So, yeah, there's a lot of money to be made here. I mean, the basic point, you know, going back to what I said earlier, you know, you ban any commodity or any service, you know, through human history, you provide a market for criminals. You know, if the demand doesn't go away, look what happened to alcohol during Prohibition. This is the same dynamics at work here. There is a massive demand for travel to a richer part of the world. Now that we've banned it, we create this huge opportunity for criminals.
To wind up, because we're nearly at the 7 o'clock, coming up to the 7 o'clock news, Alex, sure. What would you like to see done from your experience? What would help sort some of this out? Because, I mean, we cannot have a situation where organised crime is using, making fantastic amounts of money here and actually promoting this commodity of human cargo, many of which are simply dying in the process.
I guess what I'd like is a kind of adult debate. You know, I don't want to see the kind of deceitful figures and sort of rhetoric that, you know, Theresa May came out with. You know, grow up. And, you know, this is a serious situation where thousands of people are dying every year, and grandstanding for your own political ambitions is, you know, I find it pretty offensive. You know, you know, Take cognizance of the, you know, of the families that are dying.
Basic problem here, isn't there, that it's a bit unclear as to whose law it is in the Mediterranean. It seems it's nobody's law or the law of organised crime.
Oh no, I think that's fair enough. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, open seas. You know, who's in charge? But as Home Secretary in particular, you know, there's action that she can take here. You know, she's in the seat, and so to be using the situation to, you know, mess around with migration figures, the things that she was saying about net migration, she knows she's fiddling those figures. There are hundreds of, you know, over 100,000 students in those figures who are here on a temporary visa. You know, she's trying to blind us with, you know, like, grow up, let's get serious, and let's, you know, try and save some lives.
And also, Katie Hope, what are your thoughts about the solutions here?
Well, I guess it's people taking action. You know, there's been an outpouring of support for refugees and asylum seekers recently, which has been really heartening to groups like ours.
Right.
People there want to do something, and I would say there's lots of things you can do. One of them is to do things like sign a parliamentary petition that tells your own government that you want to resettle more refugees. There's one online at the moment that currently has just under 440,000 signatures. Go ahead and sign it.
Okay.
Support your local refugee groups.
Okay, thanks very much, both of you. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Our sister show Dialect, Bristol's longest running podcast, won't be here on BCFM next Tuesday. Sorry, but the show's been pulled by the management. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Chris Windows, and freelance journalist Sam Downey. Thanks also to Alex Perry and Katie Hope, you just heard there. And